The following is an at-will presentation.
Welcome to The Marrow, conversations with creatives about who they are and why they make what they make. I'm your host, Josh Reebok. Today I'm speaking with painter Daniel John Gadd. Daniel John Gadd, you're a painter. Your work has been seen from New York to California, Canada, Pennsylvania, Texas, Amsterdam. I'm such a fan of your work. Thank you so much, Daniel, for coming on The Marrow today.
Thank you.
All the way from New Jersey today?
I came from my studio in Bushwick.
Bushwick. Okay, yeah. Awesome. So here's my first question. And your work really is, it really is remarkable. And there's so much color. There's so much texture. There's so much to it. But so I'm gonna start you off with a hard question.
Fair
right?
Enough.
So please forgive me.
All right.
But for everybody, a lot of your work can be seen at danieljohngadd.com.
Yep.
Okay, so if you want to follow along with the conversation by looking at Daniel's work, please do. But here's my first question. I know it's a hard one, so I apologize up front. How would you describe your work?
Well, first, no one could see my work right now.
Yeah.
So, I'm an abstract painter. I use shapes a lot. I use different materials such as mirror, paint, wax, wood, string, silver and gold leaf. So now that you know, I guess I would describe my work as fragile, maybe violent, aggressive, and there's a lot of deep self-reflection in my work, both with the use of the mirror and without it. So
yeah. Yeah, I mean, so I'm imagining you in your studio. I mean, do you just have giant vats of all these materials kind of scattered around? And I mean, what in the world is the process like then to create one of these paintings?
Well, yeah, I guess I really I just have materials around, and I just start by, I guess, making and trying not to think about anything and just making the work, and then. Uh-huh. A lot of the work is informed by mistakes or accidents, like when I actually, because I'm working with glass mirror, so at some point it's going to break.
Hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that, different colors inform different things. I use a Sawzall a lot, so I cut a lot in my work. So you know what I mean? If I don't like something, I usually just cut it out.
Yeah, right.
And that, that came after 10 years of trying to work on this rectangle and, wanting to be in this great tradition of painting. And, I'm not the first to make a shape painting by any means, but I just got angry one day and, cut out the only part of the painting I liked. I was either like, this is amazing or this sucks. I can't tell,
One of the two.
and I had to go home and my wife was like, how was your day? And I was like, I don't know, and I played with my daughter for a little bit, and I looked at it, on the computer, and I was like, I actually think this is interesting.
Hmm.
And so, I went back and made 10 more,
really?
And was like, how interesting is this actually? And what actually does it mean?
Yeah.
And why is it important if it is?
Yeah. And I love that idea of going, I'm pretty sure I've made some mistakes here, so I'm going to decide which mistakes to kind of keep. I mean, the I think his name is Scott Adams. He's the creator and illustrator of Dilbert, the cartoon. And he has some quote, creativity is making mistakes, art is knowing which mistakes to keep.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that you're kind of describing a similar thing. So do you remember, Daniel, the first painting that you ever created?
No, but I have it, or at least I have what
as
I was
a kid.
Told.
I mean, were you a finger painter as a kid? I mean, did you just dominate art
but
class?
I don't really remember our class that much. I remember a couple of our teachers, but I have this little drawing of Mickey Mouse that I was told that was saved, and I highly doubt that was the first painting I ever made. But,
really?
But in my mind,
yeah.
It was the first little painting drawing I ever made.
What age were you?
It says, Dan, age 5. So so my daughter's 3 and a half now, and we make paintings all the time. So I'm sure,
Yeah, right.
But I guess that was the first keeper.
That was the first keeper. And I mean, so what was life like for you growing up?
I played a lot of sports. So, I was pretty good at baseball. So I just remember it being, like, very sports dominated. Like, three different teams at once and when's the next tournament and stuff. So I always enjoyed art. And my grandma used to take me to the skyline. I lived in New Jersey, so she'd take me and I would draw the skyline of Manhattan. And, you know, I always found that interesting. And decent, normal childhood,
close,
I guess.
Close with your family?
Yeah, yeah, close with my family, supportive parents.
Yeah, who in your family were you closest to growing up?
It's weird because my mom was around. She was a housewife, so we were always, you know, together. And I have some, like, crazy memories of just us doing weird things, like going to furniture stores and, like, you know. But then I have, you know, baseball and sports with my dad. I don't think that I can't ever remember my dad missing a game.
Really?
Which, you know, when you're 10 or something, is not that important. But, you know, being 30 and now a dad and thinking about the fact that I don't ever remember my dad missing a game is something pretty amazing.
And you know, that's an interesting observation because I think, like you, I think I took that for granted. My dad and I had a tumultuous relationship in a lot of ways between some of his addictions and then some of my just disinterest, I guess, in him. Mm-hmm. But even as I look back, he never missed one of my games. Even the games when I was sitting the bench and never even playing, like, my dad was there, and I'm not a father, so I can't appreciate that now to the extent that you do being a father. But I do know that life can be tiring, and I know that life can be busy, and to look back and realize that he still maintained my events as a top priority in his life, despite not only the schedule he had to keep, but even just like his own emotions, his own psychology, his own difficulties, his marriage, you know, money, all these things. Like, in retrospect, like you said, that's become way more meaningful to me now than it was when it was actually taking place.
Mm-hmm, definitely. You know, I had to miss one of my daughter's soccer games. And so I'm not off to a good start. But it hurt. It really hurt. So, you know, it's strange to realize the other side of things.
Yeah, right. Know? Yeah. Well, and you talk about, you've already mentioned your daughter multiple times. It's clear you have immense affection for you. Daniel, what are you like as a dad?
You know, like sports announcing or whatever? I'm like the color guy. Like, I'll say the funny thing and get her all riled up and then kind of look at my wife and be like, all right. You know, so we have a lot of fun. We make up these weird dances, and, you know, she knows that I paint, so she always wants to paint when I get home, which, unfortunately, is probably the last thing I want to do, you know? But yeah, it's interesting, because I didn't see myself as a dad, and I didn't necessarily plan to be a dad, but now it's obviously the most important thing in my life, so it's interesting. Everything else is for her, you know?
Are there specific ways that you can look at your life and see how fatherhood has changed you?
Yeah, completely, because there's always, you know, I love my wife very much, but as a father, it's the first thing that I've ever truly cared about more than myself. So, you know, when you're married, you're making decisions, you know, based on your family and stuff, but now it's about the well-being of a three-year-old or three-and-a-half-year-old who doesn't have a say in these choices. Yeah. My wife could tell me you're being an idiot or don't buy that jacket, you know. Abigail can't, so I have to, you know, I have to think a little bit more about her and less about myself, which, you know, sometimes could be difficult.
Absolutely. So, I sometimes I wonder if every artist is inherently self-absorbed.
Of course. Like, I think so. But
really?
At least the ones I know, I'm extremely self-absorbed.
I'm curious about this because me and an entire chorus of people could answer the same thing about me. But how do you see, I mean, where does that show up? How do you recognize in your life this sense of self-absorption?
Well, just being alone in a studio for 10 hours and making something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? When there's other things that could be done, you know, especially going back to being a family man now, you know, like I could be doing the laundry, I could be helping out, but there's this part of me that needs to be there, you know.
I've heard people talk about in the context of writing, and I would imagine that there's a parallel with painting and what you do, that writing is really this cold descent into utter isolation. And in order to, and this may not be true of everyone, but I find that for me, I don't feel like I'm kind of working at the peak of my ability, or at least what I'm striving for, unless I'm to some extent shutting not just everything but everyone out.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, you know, and I'd love to hear you talk about this, Daniel. I know that at times, like, I know for me, that really wounds people in my life at times. Like, there's times when everyone in my life, they understand, and some of my artist friends, they understand to another level, you know, because mm-hmm. they may be wired in a comparable way. But I know that at times, I've really wounded people in my life, and I struggle with that tension, and I struggle with the decision sometimes of going, okay, well, it's another Thursday or it's another Friday, and here's another 10 hours by myself where I'm going to be kind of postponing any text, ignoring every phone call, pushing any email to later. How do you navigate that tension in your life?
Well, you know, I feel bad for my wife, because it's almost like I have like a second wife in painting, where, you know, yeah. what I mean, I mm-hmm. The way I've done it successfully is I live about an hour away from my studio. Mm-hmm. So there's no lunch breaks or stopping or anything. Mm-hmm. I keep these really weird hours where I drive in at 5:30 in the morning. Mm-hmm. And I try to be home by like 4. So mm-hmm. that way, by the time she gets home from school,
yeah.
you know, I can be there.
Yeah.
You know, but still, sometimes there's this feeling of guilt that comes in, that, like you said, it's another 10 hours that I'm going to be, yeah. you know, in the studio, or it's another Saturday mm-hmm. that, you know, we can't go see Santa. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, last night, you know, I was working, and Santa comes on the fire truck and, you know, gives the kids a present. So, you know, I didn't get to see that. Mm-hmm. And, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And I don't think that I've ever been told openly that it hurts to when I'm not there, but I definitely think that I might.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, there's nothing I could do about it, because it's just who I am, yeah. you know?
Well, and I'm still learning to embrace the notion that part of the way that hopefully I bring good into the world is through those kind of intervals of isolation, that I need that in order to make something that can hopefully challenge or inspire the people around me. I remember one time, though, I don't remember if it was my wife that said this to me or a friend. And my, you know, Kristen, my wife, and you know, I mentioned before we came on the air that we're 2 weeks away from our 11-year wedding anniversary. And so, you know, I can't imagine someone more supportive. I mean, not just someone who kind of quietly golf claps while I go about my business, but someone who's genuinely rooting for me along the way. Kristen is every bit that. But I remember someone saying to me one time, they said, does it ever bother you that with your work, you may impact people around the world, but in doing so, may harm the people right under the same roof? And I, Daniel, I heard that, and I mean, I don't know if I wanted to cry or punch the person in the mouth, you know? But there's something to that. That, I mean, in some ways, that's the tension, is it's going, how do I, beyond that 10 hours alone, be present for the people immediately in my life and not just for the people who know me through my work?
Mm-hmm.
let's get back to your work, though.
I think, just to touch on that, I think without what I do, I couldn't be who I am. Mm-hmm. So the father that I am, the husband that I am, the friend that I am, mm. if I'm on a job, the employee that I am, you know, whatever, yeah. is because of all of these things that I do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's a part of it. So
yeah. And so when along this kind of a timeline of your life, when you're playing baseball, you know, you move into adolescence, I mean, at what point did you really start to gravitate towards this particular craft?
It's weird. I almost found it out of not wanting to do something else. I didn't want to play sports anymore. I didn't want to go to another baseball practice. I didn't want to go to another baseball game. And I went to an all-boys Catholic high school, and there was, like, the jocks and, like, the kids that were in art class.
Hmm.
So I just kind of, you know, started hanging out with them, and they were listening to punk music. And you know what I mean? There was, like, a total 180, you know, and from who I was. And I felt happier. I felt more accepted. And then, you know, I guess with being a little bit more free, I was allowed to realize what I truly enjoyed.
Yeah.
I had a really supportive teacher in high school who, she was the art teacher, and she just let me be me, I guess. And, from that, unfortunately, in high school, I dealt with, you know, some demons and stuff, and into college, and it was a really rough time. And after I got through that, I realized that this is life or death now, and maybe this is what I actually want to do.
Mm.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that can be an unpretty era of life.
Yeah.
I think probably for a lot of us. So how do you begin, Daniel? I mean, you go into the studio and you've got the, you know, both literal and proverbial blank canvas. How do you begin each project?
Well, literally I work on plywood. So I screw together a couple pieces of plywood and then just start working.
But before you start, do you have an end image in mind?
No, I don't. And any time that I have in the past, it's been so far from it that I feel like if I do put some sort of expectation, I'm setting myself up for some sort of failure.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? Because I feel like intuition is important in the studio.
Yeah.
And, you know, just experimentation. And if I'm thinking about something that I want to do, then I'm going to ruin it.
Hmm.
I mean, you know, preparing for a show or something, or, you know, I have a few shows lined up and the work was chosen based on, or I'm chosen based on the past work I did. So there's always like this question like, oh, well, you know, I gotta fulfill this or I got to do this
right.
Or people really like this.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And that's kind of hard. But
I would think, I mean, I think that's true for a lot of people, that how do you not almost become imprisoned to your previous work? Thinking, oh, well, this really resonated. So then it becomes, rather than a work of further creation, it becomes replication.
Of
right?
course,
and it's
yeah.
like we're just trying to like duplicate past things, either because that's where we're comfortable or that's what at least in our perception seem to resonate with the people around us.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to become like a karaoke singer myself or something, you know?
Karaoke painter.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I think two things. I get bored easily if I'm doing something in repetition too long. And then also just from my process, like, you know, cutting something in half.
Mm.
So now I have two pieces.
Mm.
And you know what I mean? Usually the counterpoint or the piece that gets screwed back on or the glass that gets glued, like kind of just allows it to evolve naturally,
mm-hmm.
Which is interesting, in that I don't have to be like, oh, I'm looking for a way out.
Yeah, right.
You know,
right.
But I had a teacher, Farrell Brickhouse, who is a dear friend and teacher, and he likes to, when he tries something new, he likes to go as far away as possible because then he says you have the middle ground to fill in.
Hmm.
Which is, I guess, an interesting thought too.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's such a fascinating thing. I mean, I have some of my friends who are in a similar field as me, writers. They begin a project and they outline. I mean, the entire thing. I mean, they've got the skeleton from the head down to the toes, all every single bone, and they know where they're going. And for them, that proves to be effective. You know,
mm-hmm.
For me, that's not at all the way I tend to work. I go, well, I know I'm going north. I don't know how I'm going to get north. I don't even know what's there when I get north. I just know I'm generally going this direction. And for me, it's a more, I don't know, I hate to use the word organic because that somehow makes it sound like it's pure or something like that. But there tend to just be a lot more twists and turns in the process along the way. And for me, while that can create some headaches, I think it can also lead to some of the best places in a narrative or linguistically, because they surprise me. And I feel like in that format, I can perhaps be a little bit more open to the unexpected,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to kind of dropping myself into a track and just racing to the finish line.
Yeah, yeah. I've built structures and I'm like, okay, it's going to hang on a wall. I know that much, you know, maybe. And, there's going to be some mirror in it. And all of a sudden things just start happening, and you know what I mean? And it's just, it's kind of incredible because I've looked and I've been like, did I just make that?
Mm.
You know? And, I'll have not finished anything for months, and I'll be like, man, I stink. I don't know what I'm doing. Mm. And then in one day, everything just comes together.
Yeah,
and, you know, all of a sudden, I just made 9 paintings, you know, so.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Then you had that kind of lightning bolt epiphany, and then, you become, like, really prolific in the span of 5 days.
Yeah, and then 2 more days, I'm like, I'm done.
And I'm terrible
over.
Again.
Yeah.
I'm terrible again. Yeah. How do you decide? I mean, looking at your work, I mean, there is an abstraction to it, but it's so there's such emotion in it, even just when I look at it. You know, like, it's the kind of thing, like, earlier this season on the Merrow, we had an architect mm-hmm. on, and he talked about how buildings talk to us. You know, and I love the way he used that language, and I think there's a similarity with your paintings where even this abstraction kind of has a particular voice, and coupled with the color and the shapes, I mean, there is such a current in your work. But how do you decide, and you and I started talking about this before we came on, but how do you decide in the midst of that when you're done? I mean, unless there's someone standing over your shoulder telling you this is now done, how do you decide?
I think it's the hardest thing in making something is deciding when you're done. Mm-hmm. So for me, I think a lot of times I just kind of get bored and want to move on, which is interesting. I think sometimes if I'm completely unhappy with something and I just turn it around and don't look at it for a month and then look at it again, a lot of times it's just done, you know?
Yeah, right.
You know, it's just like I've moved on from that. So I think that's one way. But the other way is when I can think of nothing else left to do. When I go to Photoshop and I wash it over with another color or cut another shape, and there's just nothing else there, mm-hmm. and it's a hard place because you know there's always things that you've done you know in the past 10 paintings that you can do this mm-hmm. time
yep.
you know what I mean there's
yep.
like the finishing move or the you know put a little yeah. fleck there yeah. or, you know cut there, mm-hmm. and you know I think something that's important in my paintings and maybe someone that doesn't know my work well will be like they look all the same or whatever, yeah. but I don't ever want to finish something the same way.
Hmm.
Hmm. So I think when you're sitting in front of it and you're like, I could do nothing.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Right. And I would imagine that a lot of times that's the harder choice to make. I mean, there's a little bit of like, for me, this illusion that if I tinker long enough, I can achieve some sort of perfection, or if I just do this, then. But typically, that just leads to the next moment of going, if I just do this, then. And there's something about, as artists, practicing a sense of restraint to just simply walk away and go, what does that even mean? You know, like that's such like a subjective term. I mean, and even done is completely contingent on my current emotions and my current feelings. It's like what's done to me, or in my eyes now, I may wake up tomorrow and go, it's not done at all. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it's completely like this sort of vacillating sense of what does that even mean? But you seem to have such a trust and a confidence in your intuition about when that moment arrives.
Well, I could talk about it, but you know what I mean? When you're actually sitting there and looking at it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just gave a lecture or a talk or whatever at a solo show I had at David and Schweitzer. And I had to, you know, it was like a roundtable discussion. And I'm not one for public speaking. So, so you know, people were talking. And the whole time I was just looking around the room and, like, thinking, like, what would I do now? So a month later, when they're actually considered done, when they're sold,
yeah.
you know, when they're in the gallery, when there's no more tinkering,
yeah, right.
and all of a sudden that opened up a new thing. I was like, oh, well, I could have done that.
Mm.
You know, maybe mm-hmm. if I had it again, I would.
Yeah.
You know what I
yeah,
mean? So
of course.
Yeah,
yeah well, I mean, and in the same way, it's like no story is ever done.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're telling a story, you're just choosing to end it there. But the story itself goes on and on and on. I think, you know, Hemingway has this quote where he talks about, like, you know, he's talking to this woman and he says, "Madam, no story is ever finished. They all end the same way in death. And if the story ends before that, the story's not done. That's just where the author has chosen to walk away." or what? I mean, there's like this famous, you know, conversation that Michael Jackson has following you know, the release of the Thriller album, where, you know, and so many people kind of, you know, canonize this album as one of the greatest, you know, music albums, one of the greatest feats of all time. And Michael Jackson says, well, no, it's not perfect. He's like, but it was just time to do something different. Mm-hmm. And there is something to that where it's like, it's just time, right? It's just time to move on.
I mean, I guess it's interesting, too, because as a painter, I could make another painting. I don't know about writing, where if you just wrote a novel, you know what I mean? Now it's a longer time span, I feel mm-hmm. like. So, you know what I mean? I could just make another painting. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if it's like that or not.
Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe on my good days, I feel like it's like that. And, and on other days, I just feel exhausted. But I think that raises a great point, Daniel, because to me, sometimes I tinker because I'm intimidated to start something new. Mm-hmm. And there's just a greater sense of comfort in playing with something that's almost complete. And there's almost a greater sense of fulfillment because I'm working on something that is a little more tangible at that point, rather than going, nope, done. Now I move on, and now I'm, you know, pushing the rock up the hill again from, you know, sea level or whatever like that. So sometimes I catch myself doing that, that I continue to tinker with something just because I'm afraid to start anew. Mm-hmm. So tell me this, like I'm fascinated with the idea of how you feel when you're about to walk into a gallery of your own work. I mean, people are getting programs at the door and you're standing there hiding in the back, and I mean, how does that feel for you before your work is shown to other people?
I'm absolutely petrified. I'm terrified, and you know, I don't know if it's because I don't have confidence in the work, or I'm worried about how people are going to perceive me. Mm. You know, I think a little bit is I'm very self-conscious. So, at the last show, I had I would walk around the block, and then I'd be like, okay, there's a couple more people there. My biggest fear was it was a new gallery, and I was the first artist, the first show they were having, you know, so there's a little bit of pressure there, right? You know what I mean? They came from wildly successful projects and then merged together, and, you know, and I'm like, oh, now it's my turn. You know, so I was petrified of that, and I'd walk around the block, and eventually I went in, you know? And afterwards I was like, oh, I probably should have enjoyed that more because it was amazing, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I guess I'm insanely lucky that I get to make paintings and then show them.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, has that sense of anxiety been with you for a long time?
Yeah, forever. And, you know, I chose some awful ways to cope with it in the past. So, you know, for a while now, you know, I've just been trying to deal with it without anything. And it's tough, you know? So.
Yeah. Of course. Of course it is.
Yeah.
Well, and you actually have kind of an interesting craft in that you can be standing in a room while someone is looking at your work. I mean, I don't necessarily look over someone's shoulder while they're reading my book.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I may hear what they think negatively or positively in the aftermath, but I don't tend to be present when they're kind of encountering it for the first time, whereas for you, that's, you know, at least in the gallery setting, a very likely possibility.
The best is when they don't know it's you. You know what I mean?
Have you done that? Like, come up incognito and go, "Yeah, what do you think of this?"
Not on purpose, but I've heard some people like, or I've seen some people like shake their heads, like, "Nah, I don't like that." You know, I'm like standing there, and actually, it's interesting. It doesn't hurt as bad as I thought it would.
Really?
You know?
Yeah.
It really didn't faze me, and it's happened a couple times, and you know, at your opening or, you know, your show or whatever, you know, if you're at the gallery just by chance and someone comes in, it's always, "I love your work. Oh, your work's great." You know what I mean? No one actually says, "Hey, you know, it's decent, but I think you could improve here."
Yeah, right.
You know
what
I mean? So to hear the other end was actually like, okay, I am human, you know, in this
sense.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Well, and to kind of actually get to see behind the curtain of that fear and go, oh, okay, that wasn't as big and nasty as I thought it would be.
Exactly. Like, intellectually, I can understand that. But in the moment, it's, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Abject terror.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the world of painting, I mean, I can't paint at all. I mean, I didn't have the Mickey Mouse, you know, Josh, age 5, but I tried my hand at finger painting and, you know, maybe took an art class or two. But so, you know, you talk about people criticizing your work or say, hey, you could improve here, or loving your work or whatever. But I mean, for you and in your opinion, Daniel, like what makes a great painting?
I think it's something that just resonates with me, especially after I'm done looking at it.
Yeah.
Like if I want to see it again, or if I think about it when I'm trying to sleep at night.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? I think that makes a great painting. And, you know, I guess there's two types of great paintings. There's great paintings that I identify with, that I love, and that, you know, I really enjoy because they're aesthetically something I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also, you know, maybe not something I'm interested in, you know, not something I necessarily want on my wall, not something that moves me, but that is an actual great painting. Hmm. You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. I think there's two of them, but I definitely resonate towards, you know, just walking into a room, running up to it and looking at it and then thinking about it. And,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, right. And is there anything in particular you want someone to feel or encounter when they're in front of one of your works?
No, I don't think so. I mean, they come from a deeply personal place, and you know what I mean? In a place of you know, feeling, definitely, and regret and shame, but also joy and happiness and balance.
Yeah.
So I just want, you know what I mean? That's a whole range of emotions.
Yeah, of course.
So I want somebody to feel something, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what it is, I don't think I necessarily care.
Yeah.
There's, I made this, you know, I make a lot of circles. I made this 10-foot circle, and it was right after the election and political things.
This year, the 2016.
Yeah, 2016 election and political things aside, this woman came in and just started looking at it, and you know, she kind of walked around the gallery and looked at it again, and then she just started crying.
Huh.
And that was the most amazing, joyful, beautiful experience for me.
Yeah.
Because it means that I actually maybe moved someone in some way. And she wasn't happy, and she definitely wasn't sad. She just, you know, was moved to tears.
Yeah.
Which you know, I could pretty quit now, you know what I mean?
Right,
I move someone
right.
to tears with my work, I'm
did,
done,
did
you know?
Did you ever find out what was behind those tears?
No, she just, you know, she just kind of looked at me and I looked at her and I smiled and she smiled
yeah.
and, you know, it was just part of the day. But
well, and that's, I love that mentality though, because I, to me, when I hear you say that, I think you're hitting on something that's so interesting. So earlier this season we had a principal dancer for the New York City Ballet, Megan Fairchild, and we were talking about just how ballet, opera, you know, Mozart and Tchaikovsky, these works of art, they're so moving, and sometimes we don't understand why, but they move us to tears. And like you said, they're kind of ambiguous tears. It's not necessarily joy. It's not necessarily sorrow. There's maybe either eye is weeping both, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember after talking to her, I went home and I walked home from the studio to Kristen's in my apartment, which is, you know, maybe like 25 blocks. So it's enough time to reflect. And I was really thinking about this idea of why am I so moved by, you know, string music? Why am I so moved by a painting in a way that is totally different from, you know, cinema or literature or poetry? And to me, I think you're articulating at least what I'm nearing as a conclusion, that when I go before a painting, like a work of yours, I'm not asking what does it mean. Like, I'm not asking that. I go before a painting or I hear classical music, and I'm asking the question, how do I feel? How do I feel? And it's almost like at times, not always, but at times, it's like this question of what does it mean inhibits my ability to just kind of be in front of this thing and actually just respond. And a lot of times, like, you know, with a movie or with a book or with a poem, because it's words that we associate particular meaning with, we're going, what does that mean? Or, you know, with the Eagles, it's like, well, what does the song Hotel California mean? You know, are they talking about hell or purgatory or just some, you know, strange place down in Baja California? What are they talking about? And I think that serves a great purpose, but it sounds like the moment you're describing with that woman, she's not caught up in the meaning per se. She's just going, how do I feel? And allowing herself to respond to that.
Mm-hmm. Which is, I guess maybe what I hope people do when they look at my work.
Mm.
Because, you know, my parents, you know, they don't understand abstract painting. My grandma, deeply religious, and she's like, I see a Bible in there. And it, you know what I mean? That's not what you're supposed to do. You know, at least that's not what I want you to do. And yeah. It's part of the reason why I got away from representational painting. You know, I could make like a face in agony or two figures like joined together or something and try to like push something on you.
Yeah.
But I think it's I think art in general is much more interesting when maybe you're not with that question. What does it mean, or what is this about, mm-hmm. or why am I thinking this? And just free to think what you want and be what you want. And you know what I mean? We talked a little bit about social media and the internet and stuff, and it's, you know, we're always thinking about something, and mm-hmm. just a minute to be and feel and exist is mm-hmm. is, you know, hard pressed these days. So
yeah, well, and you mentioned I'd love for you to tell the Merrill audience what you, I think you said before we came on the air, you had a, was it a professor that told you, he instructed you how he wanted you to navigate yourself at a certain museum or something like that?
Oh yeah, so Professor David Chow in undergrad in college wanted us to go up to the Met and not just spend time at the Met, but go there and look at one painting and spend time with one painting. And not for like 20 minutes, not for a half hour, but we're talking like hours. It was Friday night and they were open late. You were going to go there and you were going to look at a painting. And I thought it was the most ridiculous thing. You know, as a 20-year-old kid, I'm like, it's Friday night. I want to go do something. You know what I mean? I'm not staring at a painting all night. But, you know, I think it gets back to what we've been talking about. It's just, you know what I mean? So you're at the Met, so you're looking at this Italian painting, and you know what I mean, and it's a religious scene. But after a while, it's almost like you're just sitting there meditating to it, and it's interesting. So I don't think I have the ability to do that 10 years later, which is strange.
Really?
But I feel like the advancements in technology and also just the advancements in hustling to try to be able to do what I do wouldn't allow me to just take 3 hours, you know, and just look at a painting, which is kind of sad, but I may go try it.
it sounds kind of amazing to me. And what, and you kind of shared with me, you were kind enough to share with me almost like a companion, I don't know if you'd call it an anecdote or a parable about the man in the rocking chair.
It reminds
me of something similar. I love, please say that, because I love that.
You know,
story.
My personal favorite painter, Willem de Kooning, you know, there's this famous story about him, and I'm going to butcher it. So, but it goes something like this, where, you know, he's sitting in his rocking chair, and his wife, Elaine de Kooning, comes and brings him lunch, or breakfast, rather, and he's sitting there, you know, just rocking back and forth, and, you know, she brings him breakfast, leaves. She comes back for lunch, and, you know, the breakfast is still sitting there. And she brings him to lunch, and he's just still sitting there looking, you know. And then she brings him dinner, and, you know, both meals are still sitting there. You know, he does what he does, and he gets up, and he looks at her, and he says, "It was a great day."
And I guess who doesn't love that, you know, idea of sitting at a window, you know, with the Afghan and the hot chocolate or whatever. But there's something deeper to that, though, right?
Oh, of course. I mean, I guess also, well, you're on, he was on this gorgeous Lightfield studio on the East End of Long Island, but, you know, he's also a master, you know, mm-hmm. he can draw and paint. And in my opinion, he's, you know, mm-hmm. my favorite painter. And, you know, but just the ability to be there and look and sit and think about mm-hmm. what you're doing, or maybe not think.
Yeah, right.
You know.
Yeah, and I mean I don't function well when I'm busy, and by busy I mean just doing a lot of things that don't necessarily for me seem to have like a certain meaning or a certain purpose when I'm just kind of a cluttered calendar. I don't do well in that. And I remember I think this was in 2014, and Kristen and I had just moved to Manhattan from Charleston, South Carolina. You know, we'd only been there for about a year and a half. We moved. We arrived on like a Wednesday or Thursday or whatever it was. And that day, you know, thanks to a couple amazing friends and acquaintances, unpacked our moving truck and piled it all into our little West Village studio. And, you know, got Chinese food. And the next day woke up, unpacked everything. And then the following morning, I woke up and I was going to leave town for 2 weeks, doing some poetry and storytelling around the country. and I was exhausted. I mean, the move wore me out. I was worn out just from the previous season. I don't feel like I had kind of set a healthy tempo for my life. I mean, I was the antithesis of the man in the rocking chair at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And so I leave, and I'm, you know, going Chicago, Indianapolis, so on and so forth. And my brother-in-law, my older sister, her husband attended the University of Notre Dame. And he and I had never visited there. And I recalled while I was just outside Indianapolis this promise that he had asked me to make to him years earlier. And he said, hey, just promise me if ever you're near South Bend, just block out 3 or 4 hours and go to the University of Notre Dame. And I, you know, I knew Notre Dame, you know, in the sense of like I knew their football team and like really mm-hmm. not much else. And so on this one particular day, I felt like I couldn't stop. I felt like I had too much to do. I had a speaking engagement that night. I had some writing deadlines I was on. On top of that, you know, my wife was here in Manhattan in a new city. And I'm, not that she needs me to take care of her, but still I want to try. And so I felt like I couldn't stop. But for whatever reason, I just said, you know what? I'm just going to go to Notre Dame. I just need to stop. And I got there, and they just happened to be on fall break. And so I arrive at this very deserted campus, and it's, you know, autumn in the Midwest. And so, you know, all the leaves are changing colors, and they're reds and yellows, and some of them were kind of, you know, blanketing the grass. And the University of Notre Dame, I mean, it has a very kind of medieval feel in terms of its aesthetic. I mean, it's, you know, kind of castle-like buildings, and there's poetry engraved on the outer walls, and there's grotesques and gargoyles and statues everywhere. And I walk kind of into one of the center quads, and there are these kind of, like I said, very medieval buildings on the sides, and just this long hallway of trees with their, you know, leaves that just like, you know, look like they're on fire. And I just walk by myself, and it was quiet. And this may have been how you felt after 10 minutes in front of the painting when you're 20 years old. Something in me was like, okay, what's next? But I kind of resisted the urge and said, I'm just gonna keep walking, just marinate mm-hmm. in the silence, right? And so I kept walking until I arrived at, you know, what they call the Basilica, which is just like this, you know, very, very big, very beautiful cathedral. And I walked right up to the oak doors, and I thought, I need to get back to it, I need to get back to work, I need to be productive. And yet again, I resisted the urge, and I went inside, and I went in, and I mean, this place is just, I mean, it's magnificent. I mean, you know, you've got the stained glass windows, and you've got, you know, the painted ceilings. It looks like, you know, this star field overhead, and there's all these just, you know, ornate columns with gold filigree. And I went and I sat in the back pew, and there's no one in this place. It's totally vacant. And I sat there, and after 10 or 15 minutes, I thought, I need to get back to it. And, I mean, Daniel, I was so tired. Not just, like, bones, you know, but, like, head tired. And like you, you know, I deal with my anxieties and making people happy and, you know, making myself happy and looking in the mirror and being content with me. And I felt like I felt like it wasn't okay for me to just stop. Like, I felt like unless I'm making something magnificent, then I'm, you know, what am I? And so I sat there in 30 minutes, 45 minutes, an hour. And finally, after like an hour in the basilica, on top of however long my walk had been, I just started weeping. I mean, I all of a sudden was the woman in your gallery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't even know what it was other than, I mean, I guess, you know, paralleling what we were saying before, I wasn't going, what does all this mean? And what am I doing? All this stuff. I just said, how am I feeling? But it took me like an hour and a half or whatever it was on top of a drive and all the silence kind of in this refuge for me to finally, I mean, I guess, become acquainted with and acknowledge with what was going on in me so that I could kind of release it and just feel it and be in that moment. I mean, it's one of the most, for me, powerful moments I've had in the last, you know, 2-3 years.
I feel like we don't get enough of that, you know?
Yeah.
And maybe that's why, at least for me, it is important, you know, going back to talking about, you know, maybe being creative, but being self-centered and selfish and, you know, 10 hours alone and, at least you have some of that. And when I have that, I could be the best person I could be.
Yeah. Yeah. And for me, there's something too about allowing myself not just to feel when I'm alone, but like engaging the people around me with those things going on inside of me rather than being most engaged when I'm alone. And mm-hmm. then kind of like, you know, snapping on the autopilot all of a sudden when I'm surrounded by or even just with one person.
I don't know. I just feel like I'm just always quick to do something. You know what I mean? You're talking about resisting the urge.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's so important to just be sometimes.
Yeah.
And, you know, going back to that woman and just looking at art or reading something and, you know, maybe not being forced to feel a certain way, but just being allowed to feel is maybe something that is completely precious.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've been married now. You mentioned this earlier, and, you know, we're talking about feeling and just engaging the world beyond our art, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You've been married now for how long?
4 years.
How did you meet, is it Alexis?
Alexis,
how
yeah.
How did you meet Alexis?
I met Alexis, someone that I'm very close to told me to go on a date with her. And I'm not going on a blind date, and I was completely content being, you know, 26 years old and you know, just, you know, not having to worry about anything, mm-hmm. you know, except mm-hmm. for myself.
Yeah, right.
And I went on the date, and we were both vegetarians, so we went to this vegetarian restaurant, the only one in New Jersey that I know of. so we went there in Montclair, and I met her, and I was like, I'm screwed, you know, like, you know, after the food, we're like, what are we going to do now?
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? Nobody said it, but there was this, like, we're not leaving each other yet type of feeling. And we went to a bookstore. And, you know, we just walked around this bookstore and, you know, I think we didn't want to leave. We were so upset that, you know, it was a lunch date, first of all,
Nice.
So it was like everybody's got plans after.
Nice.
You know, I had the fake plans just in case, you know, and she's like, well, you got to be there. I'm like, no, I don't.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, so we talked and we were in the, you know, gravitated toward the art book section, and I'm just kind of looking around and nervous as hell, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And she somehow came up that she'd never been to the Met.
Hmm.
And I was like, you never been to the Met, you know.
Yes.
I went every Friday night and looked at a painting for 3 hours, you know. I'll show you the Met. So so we went the next day. And,
so you saw her admission she'd never been as the opportunity to double down on
date
number
two. Let's go. Like we should go, right? And you know, she's shy and timid, and she's like, yeah. And I'm like, you know, and then in my head, I'm like, is this the pity year?
Yeah, right.
But we ended up, we went to the Met, and then we went to the Museum of Natural History, and then we had a great vegetarian restaurant, Blossom. and then from the Upper West Side, we walked to the Brooklyn Bridge, walked over the Brooklyn Bridge.
Wow.
It was like, it was like the epic dating decathlon. The second date that solidified the third date and the marriage and, you know.
Mm.
And she was a school teacher, so that was the summer, so I didn't paint at all that summer.
Oh, yeah, right.
You know
right.
what I mean? we were just doing things and hanging out and, you know what I mean? It was beautiful. And then, like 4 months later, we moved in together.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
did you ever see your? I mean, previous to you know this you know, star-crossing with Alexis. I mean, previous to that, did you foresee marriage and falling in love in your future?
You know, it's weird because I'd spent like 3 years without a girlfriend or like even like significant dates or anything, and you know, we talked about you know, almost like at least my studio and my art practice is like this fortress of solitude where it's just me, and I was very happy not knowing that I didn't have to worry about something else other than that. Mm-hmm. You know, I was very focused on what I was doing, but at the same time there was a part of me that was missing. You know, so possibly I wanted to get married. You know, I don't know. You know, I think maybe it was like a one day type thing, but not today.
But not today.
Yeah.
I think I mean, I look back on, you know, previous years of my life, and you know, we're about to be married 11 years, but I think I look back, and I never wanted to just get married. Like, it was never marriage, but I'm a, you know, I think internally I'm a very hopeful person. Mm-hmm. I'm a very hopeful skeptic. That's probably the best way to put it. But I think I was very, very, very afraid to fall in love, like really be in love with somebody, because I knew that would subject me potentially to lost love and mm-hmm. heartbreak.
Of course.
And so for me, there was something. I just felt safer kind of dismissing the notion that I would ever not only be in love, but that I even wanted love. And like you, once Kristen and I, you know, went out, I mean, it was a ticking clock for me at that point. I was just like, this girl's amazing. And I feel this real, I just felt so accepted. I felt so accepted. I felt complete autonomy to be me when I was with her. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel like I had to be, the limited edition version of Josh. I didn't have to be leather interior Josh. I could just be me, you know, T-shirt and jeans and guy who hates doing laundry and who sometimes has stains on his shirt. You know, I could be that Josh. I could be the Josh that was insecure, and I could be me in the sense that of the things I loved and the things that made me laugh and the things that made me happy. And I think when I found that with her, and then fell so deeply for who she was as a person, the idea of being without that for me was just absurd. It was just a completely, completely ridiculous thing to think about. And so I actually told her I loved her within the first month.
Oh, yeah, me too. Yeah.
You did? Yes.
Yeah, no, I think it was quick. It was one of those, like, I just said that.
Did you, like, almost blurt it out?
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. It was the same thing for sure.
What did she say in response?
She was receptive. I think I got an I love you too.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, see, that's better than me. I told Kristen, I go, I love you, and she looked at me, and you know, this is going to cloak me under the already, you know, nerdy label that I deserve, because she, what I would say, she Han Solo'd me when I said, I love you. And she, like Han Solo in Empire Strikes Back, when Leia says, I love you, Kristen said, I know. Yeah. And she, so there's like a part of me that, like, after I like duct taped my soul back together and like put it back in me, I realized that there's actually something amazing about that, because then I knew that if I reached a time when she would say it, I knew that I could trust it.
Yeah.
And I knew that it wasn't just a pressured reciprocation. And so, you know, however long it was later, one night, you know, after we'd gotten like ice cream or something, she's like, I love you too. And then that was like, for me, given my insecurities and, you know, you mentioned some of your internal demons, you know, if that's a term we want to use, that you had kind of combated for a while. For me, and knowing what some of my dysfunctions are and some of my downfalls, for me to hear her say, I love you, and being able to believe it was it was just momentous for me. And I don't know. I mean, and now, you know, yeah, we're a few weeks away from anniversary number 11.
Yeah, that's amazing. Now I'm thinking about like that summer, the summer when I met her, and unfortunately, you know, we have a daughter, we just bought a house, like we have all these things that come in the way of actually her and I mm-hmm. being her and I, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and it's strange how life gets in the way, but
yeah, isn't that amazing?
Yeah, yeah.
What I want to come back to your work for a second, because And you've mentioned this, that you draw so, you draw deeply and really personally in order to make your art. And it's clear just from being in here with you, Daniel, that you feel very deeply, like that you feel the world around you, that you feel all, I don't know, the whole spectrum. I mean, you even mentioned, even when in describing your work, that there's a certain fragility and a certain violence that you tend to draw on. I mean, is there a certain type of emotion that you tend to draw on most in making your art?
I don't think so. I think something that's very important to me in my whole life is just finding some sort of balance. Mm. So I think, I want to be balanced in art making. I want to be balanced husband, balanced father. You know what I mean? But, when I'm in the studio, the whatever happened before dictates, unfortunately, what goes into it, and whatever is gonna come later. Like today, for example, I was making things. I'm covered in sawdust right now. I know people can't see me.
But I noticed that. It made me feel better. Yeah, I'm always covered in something.
Yeah, and I was making these new panels for a show in New Haven in a couple months, and I was nervous that I had to come here later. You know what I mean? So I was thinking about it all day, and So I think maybe a little bit of a little bit of nerves came in today. I think and maybe a little sadness today. You know what I mean? But tomorrow I could be really happy.
Yeah. Right.
You know. So yeah. I think when there's some sort of balance in the work, that's when it allows people to resonate with it the most, and going back to it, just feel something or be.
Yeah. What inspires you?
My daughter. My daughter inspires me. The last show I had at David and Schweitzer was called For the Moon, and her middle name's Moon. So when we named our daughter, my wife is a lot more traditional than I am. I was like, let's name her like Rainbow or Moon or something, And it was a supermoon in June of 2013. And so we settled on Abigail. We agreed on Abigail. And, you get this birth certificate, or you have to fill it out or whatever, and they're like, what's her middle name? And I'm like, I don't know, we don't know. And in my mind, I'm like, Moon, 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 Moon. And she's like, do you want it to be Moon? And I'm like, yes. Oh, please. Thank God. So we call her Moon a lot at home, or Moonie. Hmm. So, when I started making abstract paintings, she was about 1 year old, and a lot of me doing that was wanting to be able to communicate with her. She was starting to look at shapes and colors and stuff. And so why the heck am I painting, that some figure that people, that I'm not even that good at anyway. You know what I mean? I'm not Rembrandt. I'm certainly not de Kooning. So, so I was trying to communicate with her in a way, and I cut this circle out. That was the first, shape painting I made. And all of a sudden, it just, she has no clue what it means. You know what I mean? But it was my way of allowing her into my practice. Mm. And it was defining for me, of course.
Yeah. So. Absolutely. So she inspires you.
Of course. Yeah. Definitely.
What's been the best year of your life, Daniel?
Let's go with this one. Let's go with this one.
I like that.
There's been some terrible things that have happened in the world, but maybe not in my personal life. And I'm for better or worse, a much more personal person than letting news events or something. Yeah. They don't affect me as much for some reason. But my daughter is, 3 now. She can have a conversation. She can say, I hate you, Dad. She can say, I love you, Dad. Which is amazing. And she hate is a strong word, but when she says that, I don't believe her. But when she says, I love you, I believe her now. Yeah. You know what I mean? She knows what it's like to actually feel. Hmm. For my career, it's been the best year, too.
What's been the hardest year of your life?
2009. No, 2007 was the hardest year of my life. I was struggling with addiction really bad. Hmm. And I ended up getting clean in 2007. Hmm. And so it's, it's been almost 10 years now.
Wow.
So that was definitely the hardest year.
Yeah. Yeah. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a huge fan of your work. I mean, everybody go to Daniel John Gadd com. See what Daniel is doing. I mean, and you know, like he said, don't don't just scroll through them all in you know 20 minutes, but sit with one for 20 minutes. Daniel, thank you so much for coming on the Marrow. I really do cherish you and cherish your work and just the whole, I know, your whole way of approaching life and balance and everything that you do. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Josh. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for listening to The Marrow. To find me on social media for upcoming live appearances or to buy a book, you can visit joshreebach.com. But please join me again next week.